Welcome to ICOM Radios in Action, Aviation. Here I am today with Brian Norris. Brian and I have known each other for many years. And Brian, you've led a very interesting life.
That's to say the least. Yes, sir.
When you and I first met, do you remember that day walking into the hangar in Oshkosh?
I don't remember the day specifically, but I could probably get it pretty well narrowed down. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, it was one of those very hot days where concrete sweated and things like that. You never think about Oshkosh, Wisconsin getting very hot, but you were dressed all in black, and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me with how hot it is today.
Well, like you are today.
Yeah, but I'm in a nice air-conditioned room, so... Take it from there, sir. What were you doing walking around?
Well, for those who don't know, I spent almost 25 years with this up-and-coming air show guy named Sean D. Tucker, and that's how we met. We were at Oshkosh. I really don't remember what year it would have been, but most likely it was early in Sean's career. Probably had one of our very first sponsors for the team, but I was trying to find supporting or what we call product sponsors. And interestingly, and you know this very well, Sean was a fanatic about keeping the airplane as lightweight as possible. And this was early days when he still was flying a modified version of a Pitts. He has a pretty robust competition background, and that's kind of where the whole fanatical weight-saving thing used to come in. So anytime we wanted to improve the airplane in any way, his first question is, how much weight is it going to add to the airplane? And, you know, back then the radios were a little bit bigger. And so we came up with the idea that if we could modify an ICOM handheld, and I don't remember which model it was at the time, I probably still have it, that would save a tremendous amount of weight. And so for years, Sean's airplane, we only had a single ICOM handheld radio with the battery removed, and we had it hardwired into the airplane. And then the antenna jack went to an antenna on the outside of the airplane. And by doing that, the radio worked fantastic. We never had a problem with it. And we saved, you know, probably at least a pound. And that doesn't sound like much to most people. But for Sean, if it was anything over about 4 ounces, we had to make a pretty strong case why that widget needed to be added to the airplane. So that's how we met originally. And then we became good friends. We became product sponsors, you know, during our ribbon cuts. That if anybody remembers Sean doing the triple ribbon cut, we always had crew members on each of the three positions. Of course, I was Sean's narrator for a long time. So we had a pretty large collection of ICOM handhelds that you supplied us with, and they never let us down. Had a great time.
Yeah, that particular radio, and I've got to check through my photo archives. I've probably got a photo of it, was the ICA-22. It was a small black radio, very large display for the actual physical size of the radio itself. And it was beautiful how you had it mounted in there. And to take a look at some of Sean's stunts, like the centrifuge, what kind of G-forces would he and that radio see that was trying to rip him out of the seat and rip it off the off the panel?
Well, it wasn't uncommon during the course of one performance. Sean would see upwards of 11 to 12 positive Gs, which is just crazy to imagine. But even crazier than that is he would routinely see about 6 negative Gs in a show. So, yeah, both him and the equipment put up with a lot of abuse. And that's why I used to claim that for any of our product sponsors, we were great beta testers for any new product they were coming out with. Because if Sean couldn't break it, it wasn't going to break. And I think we proved that quite often with a lot of different equipment.
Well, the radios that we have today, I call them more age appropriate for our customer base. It's a lot larger display on a radio. You can see it without glasses. And it's funny that the new young pilots look at me like I've lost my mind. But when you have a pilot our age or older, and I say age appropriate, they immediately start laughing because, yeah, I can see that thing.
Yeah, no, I understand completely.
So 25 years. Wow. I didn't realize it was that long. Wow.
Yeah, it was 24 full seasons. And then I kept doing air shows, and even now still do some air show or still involved in some air shows. But then even after I left traveling with Sean full time, I still did a lot of work with him, a lot of like waivers and just a lot of computer stuff for interfacing with our sponsors and past sponsors and friends. So yeah, and we're still a great friend, still in touch quite often.
And I think he's got one of the few airplanes that actually have flown in his shows at the Smithsonian, right?
That's correct. That is our last airplane. We called it the Oracle Challenger 3. And our last few airplanes were custom built just for Sean. The misconception was that Sean flew a modified Pitts, and that was true up until around 2000. And from that point on, the airplanes that we had were custom built just for Sean by some amazing people. And then we would finish the airplanes the way we wanted them. So that last airplane was called the Oracle Challenger 3. We first flew it in 2010, and it was donated to the Air and Space Museum. And then I was fortunate enough to, I think it was three summers ago, while the general aviation side of the museum was closed, and this is the downtown museum, not at the Hazy Center. While it was closed, I was fortunate enough to be invited to come participate in actually hanging the airplane up in the museum. The interesting thing is it's no longer an airplane. It is now called an artifact. I was corrected every time I would refer to it as an airplane. And interestingly enough, you know, the museum owns the airplane. It's not ours. And the bureaucracy in the Smithsonian organization is just like any other government entity. There's layers upon layers upon layers. So by the time you got to the people that were actually hired or contracted to hang the airplane, you know, they were subcontracted from this company, which was subcontracted from here. So I'm so far removed from this process anymore. I wasn't even allowed to touch the artifact. I was mainly there to offer tech support, or if I saw something that they were doing that was maybe out of order or wasn't going to go well, I was invited to come speak up freely, but I was not at any point allowed to actually touch the airplane or help in any way. And what made it even more challenging was, you know, the airplane's in multiple pieces. The wings are off, and, you know, most of the large pieces were off of the airplane. The gallery that it was hung up in already had a lot of the studio lighting hanging from the ceilings. So they determined it was going to be impossible to assemble the airplane right side up and then rotate it. So we actually had to build the airplane or reassemble it upside down and then hang it up from the ceiling. And that's how it sits today. It's upside down in a little bit of a bank and a dive. So that was a very interesting 5 days of my life, and I'm glad I got to do it because it was quite an honor to be there and watch how this whole thing happens.
Well, it's funny that you said we hung it, although you could not touch the artifact.
That's right. Yeah,
you were only in a supervisory role.
Yep, I would just had my little corner. I would stand there, and every once in a while, somebody would come over and say, "Excuse me, Mr. Norris, could you tell us how we should do this?" Or like I said, if I saw they were assembling something in the wrong order or something was out of place, you know, I could go over and point it out. And but the only times I actually touched the airplane was, I remember there was some time where, I don't know what they were doing, but the airplane's swinging back and forth. So they asked if I could hold on to it. And the one time I actually did anything was before they finally elevated it up to its final position. I asked if I could go in and set the cockpit up the way it would be if Sean were actually flying the airplane. So rather than have it static with all the switches and everything turned off, I went in and set everything in the airplane the way I know it should have been, as though he were actually diving at the ground with the smoke system on. So I'm in there flipping switches and turning things, and that's how I left it. And the other thing that was kind of cool is every member of our team had the opportunity to sign the inside of the airplane. So all of our signatures are inside of it. And you know, who knows? It'll be hanging up there for 100 years, and in 100 years from now, somebody pull it down, and they're going to find all that stuff in there. So, it's pretty cool.
Well, there you go, sir.
And it does have the ICOM logo proudly displayed on it for all to see.
Well, we'll challenge those that watch this video podcast to send us photos of where they think they found the ICOM logo.
There you go. Perfect.
So let's fast forward a little bit. You stayed in aviation, you have the passion for aviation, but you're not the only aviator in your household.
No. Actually, I'm very lucky. I'm married to the greatest woman on earth, and we both come from aviation families. So my dad was a Marine aviator. He flew A-4s and Harriers, and that was my intended path. I was going to join the Marine Corps. I just wanted to fly jets like my dad did, and maybe even with my dad. Went to a commission or got in a commissioning program for the Marine Corps. Went to the same school as my dad. Studied for the same degree. Had two of the same professors as my dad. Made it to OCS and was about 5 days away from completing the course, and my knee got injured bad enough where they kicked me out of the program, and I had a guaranteed flight contract. So unfortunately, that was quite a mess, and I had never really made a plan B, and that's kind of how I ended up in the air show business. So that wasn't meant to be, but my wife, Devin, she's an airline pilot, and she comes from a line of aviators. Her father was a airline pilot for Eastern. Most of his career was at Pan Am, made it all the way up to flying the 747 back in the glory days. Her mother was a stewardess for Pan Am in the glory days, as we say. Imagine the, you know, the white gloves and the great uniforms and the wonderful food on board. And there's times I'll talk about my mother-in-law and I'll point out that she was a stewardess for Pan Am, and people will say, "Oh, you mean a flight attendant?" I go, no, she was a stewardess. And if she were standing here, she would correct you herself and say she was never anybody's attendant. She was very proud to be a stewardess. And then one generation removed from that is Devin's grandfather was a pilot and a C-47 instructor in World War II. So, yeah, airplanes everywhere. We love it.
Well, that's great to hear about the military backgrounds. I had breakfast couple of days ago with a gentleman whose father, he brought his father's logbook in showing where he flew for the first time at the age of 16 in a, I think it was a J-4 Piper Cub. I'm guessing at this point,
three is a Cub,
I'm hoping I'm getting all the numbers right. Anyway, he went out of high school directly into the military. And we got to see actual logs from somebody that flew a P-51. Yeah. That was so cool seeing that and seeing the notes and everything that he did on it. And he did most of the alphabet. I mean, they did all the way up to what? P-51F?
The H.
Okay. He was in reconnaissance. So, I mean, that was incredible to see that piece of history.
Yeah. Well, and there's not much of that left, unfortunately. So that's why we have to honor these guys while we still can.
I remember the two most famous P-51s. One was Glamorous Glenn. And then the other one was Crazy Horse.
Yep.
What's the history on Crazy Horse?
I'd have to look up the long history. I know it had quite a bit of history before Lee Lauterbach acquired it and then turned it into Crazy Horse for Stallion. So I'd have to look that up I tend to get our airplanes mixed up because they all have such amazing histories. But it's actually been flying as a TF-51, you know, conversion. What a lot of people don't realize is every Mustang ever built, 15,500 of them roughly, we're all built with one seat. There is no such thing as an original two-seat dual control Mustang. They were the ones that we see today and that I fly over at Stein were all conversions that were done to original single-seat airplanes. So once that airplane was
So the space, and I just remember this from somebody mentioning it. It could be fact or it could be fictitious, but to make the two-seat version, the modification, wasn't it a jump seat that used to have their extra fuel tank?
Right. Yes. Yeah. So there's two different ways that you'll see a Mustang configured nowadays. So like a straight D model, which, you know, most of them are just a still single seat, single set of pilot controls, D model. When the thing rolled out of the factory, where the rear jump seat, as you call it, is located now would have back then had in many instances a fuel tank, but then also a lot of avionics. So you got to remember back in the day, you know, a radio instead of being this little box like we're used to today was the size of a microwave oven. I mean, they were gigantic and weighed a ton. So after the war, and even in wartime, they did some battlefield conversions where they would have removed the fuel tank and some of those avionics to put just a seat in there. So most D model Mustangs you see nowadays have that jump seat, but there are no controls. There's no pedals. There's no stick. There's no instruments. It's just a place to sit. The TF51s like we have at Stallion, and there's quite a few of them out there now, I think probably about 30 or 40 of them. Those were actually converted to actually put a full set of flight controls and a full instrument panel in the back seat. And that's what we have over at Stallion. And there'll be quite a few of them at Oshkosh as well. So after the war, as an interesting story, it'd be something great to talk about on the podcast, is after World War II, you know, we started to develop this newfangled contraption called a jet airplane. Well, the progression in World War II was this, a young kid would start flying, like, say, a Stearman. Then they'd get into a something like a BT-13, then a T-6, which we all know. Well, every one of those airplanes, they were flying it with an instructor the whole time. After they got out of the T-6, they got into a Mustang, which weighed, you know, maybe a third as much, but it had almost three times the horsepower. But it only had one seat, so they didn't have an instructor with them. So it was a recipe that didn't always work out really well. There was a lot of training accidents because of it. So now, fast forward, you know, 6-7 years as we're leading up into Korea, we've got these single seat jet fighters that we're rolling out the door. Well, we're still taking kids from a T-6 and now putting them in those fighters, and that was a pretty big leap. So what they did was they realized they needed a intermediate step there, and they needed a high performance trainer to get them ready for the jet. So they actually took 15 D model Mustangs that were all built in 1944, returned them to the factory in Dallas, and along with a company called Temco, did those first original 15 conversions where they did put the full set of controls in them. So they were basically used as high performance trainers as an intermediate step between the T-6 and the jet. So they weren't meant to be fighters. They weren't meant to teach gunnery. So they had the guns removed, all the armor plating and all that. And so that's kind of the genesis of what we now fly and know as the TF-51. So it's pretty amazing airplane. And just it's and in many instances, it's kind of life changing to see the effect it has on people when they come and fly. I mean, not just go for a ride. They get to actually fly the airplane through the sky, you know, all the way down to landing. And the person that got in the airplane isn't the same person that climbs out at the end of the flight. It's pretty amazing to watch the transformation.
I bet it is a life-changing experience to be able to fly in one of those.
It is. And it's, you know, just the different people that come to fly, you know, some are pilots. Well, right now they have to be pilots, and we can go into that whole thing later. There's an FA thing that's going around right now that we're trying to get it resolved where you don't have to be a pilot to fly in the TF. There's been a period of time just recently where they've changed it, and I think it'll get changed back. But I've had people come fly who, you know, clearly very successful in life, pilots, and they just want to add the Mustang to their list. I've had, I remember one kid was an enlisted guy in the Army, and his grandfather flew Mustangs, and he scrimped and saved for 4 years to be able to go for a flight in a Mustang just because that's what his grandfather did, and everything in between. I mean, it's just amazing the stories and the reasons why people come to fly with us. Years ago, when I was flying Mustangs with the Collings Foundation, I had the opportunity to take a gentleman flying who had, during the war, he was a squadron commander and flew P-40s in the Aleutians. And after the war, he actually flew Mustangs, and he was 96 years old.
Oh, wow.
And we became very good friends. He came out to where we were in Tampa, got in the back of the airplane of a TF-51, so dual control. And we had cameras on board, and getting him in and out of the airplane was the biggest challenge of the flight, because once he was in the airplane, he was back home, man. We went out, flew around. There's about an hour long video on YouTube. It made the ABC Nightly News and all that. And he flew the airplane for probably half the flight. He did a bunch of aerobatics all by himself. And we went back and landed in Venice while we're on tour. And like I said, we became good friends. He became kind of a rock star after that TV appearance on ABC Nightly News. And he started going around giving talks and presentations. And he was Unfortunately, he passed away. I think he was 98 or 99 when he passed away, but he was already planning his 100th birthday, and he was sharp as a tack. He remembered everything he'd ever done in his entire life, and that just I'll never forget hanging out with Bob. Bob was an amazing man.
And just to think they were thrown in those airplanes with maybe a couple of months of training and probably not much older than 18 or 19.
Absolutely.
But that brings us into your new life now. What do you do now?
Well, I don't know, maybe I get bored with stuff easy. I like to do a lot of different things. So I'm in my hangar right now. You can see our little Cherokee 140s behind me. We just bought that, and unfortunately, it used to belong to a very close friend of ours in California who passed away suddenly last September. And I had offered to help his wife sell the airplane, and then we got to thinking about it and decided it'd actually be a really nice airplane for Devin to have. And I actually use it to commute to, as you say, my new life. So it's a good little runabout. But in addition to having my own shop, I'm an A&P and an IA. I don't really have my shingle hung out to be the local mechanic just because I'm so busy doing other stuff. But I do have a core group of customers that I maintain their airplanes. Mostly aerobatic or warbird type airplanes, because that's just my background. I have up until recently was flying and managing a brand new PC-12 NGX, and I still fly and manage and maintain a Citation M2. So I get to fly, old airplanes, some of the newest, latest, and greatest stuff. We, in addition to our little Cherokee, we also have a J3 Cub. But then the newest opportunity that I've been given that I'm still kind of pinching myself that happens is, as of last fall, I'm the newest instructor at an organization called Stallion 51 over in Kissimmee, Florida, and we're known worldwide for doing a full Mustang, P-51 Mustang checkouts. So if you buy a Mustang and want to learn how to fly it, you come see us, and we'll get you through the course. We also do orientation flights because all of our Mustangs are dual control. They're a model called a TF-51, so they have a full set of controls in the back seat. So if somebody wants to experience what it's like to fly a P-51, you can come see us at Stallion, and we'll go up for an hour. And it's not a ride. We do not do rides at Stallion 51. It is training 100% of the time, and we're very proud of to say that pretty much if you get in either the Mustang with us or our T6, we have a T6G that we fly. You, as the customer, are going to fly the airplane 90 to 95% of the time, and you will have your hands on the controls at all times. So it's a pretty unique opportunity. I've known Lee Lauterbach and Angela West for decades. I've always dreamt that, even though I have probably close to 400 hours in a Mustang when this opportunity presented itself, I had always said that I would gladly trade that 400 hours of prior experience just to do a 10-hour checkout from scratch, just because they're that good, and I would learn that much more about an airplane that I thought I already knew. And once I did do that, it turned out to be right. I learned so much. Didn't realize how much I didn't know about the Mustang until I went there. And it's the world's best part-time job, Ray. I can let them know when I'm available, or more likely when I'm not available, if I'm off flying the jet or something else. And then we've got a core group of instructors. We've got, well, summertime right now, we're down to about three instructors because it gets pretty slow. It's so hot here in Florida right now, and some of the airplanes disappear for the summer because they're off on the air show circuit. And so they'll just, as they get inquiries, they'll see which of us are available, and I'll hop in the little Cherokee and buzz over there and spend the afternoon flying a Mustang or a T6. What could be better?
There you go. Well, I do a lot of stuff with the warbirds, especially around Oshkosh and EAA. And it's been interesting in our 25 years of knowing each other, the number of P-51 Mustangs have exploded. And not in a bad way. I mean, there are in Fighter Town at Oshkosh, there is more P-51s than I've ever seen. And probably a real good friend of yours is the Roush family, and how he has gone from owning a P-51 to creating replacement parts, a completely new industry. And it's been mind-boggling to see the number of these planes that he's helped keep in the air.
Yep. Yeah, all of our airplanes have Roush Merlin engines on them. He's an incredible shop. And actually, I was very fortunate. Several months ago, I was on a trip in the Citation, and we went up to Ypsilanti, Michigan, because the owner of the airplane actually had a meeting with Jack. And so while they were doing their meeting, I had the opportunity to take a tour through their Merlin shop. We just coincidentally happened to be in the same building where the Merlin shop was. And up until that time, I don't know if I'd call it a concern that we were going to run out of Merlin engines anytime soon, but I figured it was, you know, something that was just a finite quantity, and sooner or later it was going to get critical. And after touring that shop, it's restored my faith that we're not going to run out of Merlin engines anytime soon, because they are so talented and they have such capability there of being able to resuscitate and, as you said, even fabricate new parts. It was absolutely mind-blowing to see how awesome this shop was and what they're capable of. I mean, just imagine being in a room and seeing just rows and rows of Merlin engines, either fully assembled that are just there for the owners, you know, they kind of store them for them, or engines that were in various stages of being overhauled. It was fantastic. They should give tours in that place. It was so cool.
It's been interesting over the years to listen to the Warbird pilots, especially the ones that flew the Mustangs. They're like, right after the war, there was such a surplus of P-51s. You could buy one for $500. And today people are like, $500 here, let me peel off a few right now. But back in that day and age, $500 was an astronomical amount of money. But these guys would barnstorm with them, things like that. And now today, there are a few artifacts, it's good to see that they're still flying.
Yeah, there's it's probably one of the most popular questions if you're in the Mustang world. Well, number one question that I personally number one question is, which engine is in this particular Mustang? And it's pretty safe to say in most instances, it's going to be a Merlin. And probably my second most popular question is, how many Mustangs are flying in the world right now? And my standard answer to that is, it's a moving target, because, as you mentioned, you know, the airplanes have become so valuable. A lot of airplanes that had just been sitting are now going through full restorations to get them airborne again. So as a restoration is completed, that'll add one more to the airworthy registry. And unfortunately, if one gets involved in an accident, that takes one off the registry. And it's safe to say, if an airplane is involved in an incident, it's probably going to get rebuilt. So that number doesn't stay constant, but it hovers from what I've been told most recently, probably about 160, 170 flying Mustangs in the world. Most of them are in the U.S., but there are quite a few in Europe. And the interesting thing, to circle back to Stallion 51, it's not uncommon in the wintertime to, like I said, come into our hangar, and of the 160, 170, there'll be five of them sitting in our hangar. It's just, it gives you goosebumps to look down. It's like, you know, like you go to Oshkosh, you see, you know, 30 Mustangs sitting in the grass. It's just unbelievable.
Well, that figure that you just shared just amazes me with how many that we will see at Oshkosh. That any given time that we will see a quarter of all the flying Mustangs right there. Now, I do see in your background a telltale that not only do you fly at altitude, but you fly on the ground. It looks like you got a little toy in the background.
Oh, yeah, I should have brought it to the forefront. That is actually a 1974 Triumph TR6. Bright yellow. And there's a very special story about that car. Is when I was growing up, my parents were divorced. As I mentioned, my dad was a Marine aviator, spent most of his stateside time. It seemed like he always ended up in Yuma, Arizona. You know, that was kind of the TAC headquarters on the West Coast for the Marine Corps. So as a student, as an instructor, and finally as a squadron commander for a Harrier squadron, he was in Yuma. Well, when I was probably around 14 or 15, every summer I'd go spend probably about 2 weeks with my dad. And by the time I was 14, he had a car that looked exactly like that. The only difference was it had the stock steel wheels instead of those wheels. And so we'd go driving around, and I just thought that was the coolest car ever. Well, fast forward 2 years, and now I'm 16 years old with a driver's license. My dad only had the one car. He had to go to work every day. So we would drive from his house in Yuma out to the base. I'd drop him off, and then it was my car for the rest of the day. So I can very clearly remember driving around the base, and people would salute, you know, the car, because it had the sticker on it showing that it was an officer's car. But I just thought it was cool because I thought they were saluting me. And I don't know that my dad even knows this to this day. I would drive out the back gate, drive all the way around the base and come in the front gate, because those guys would really snap to attention and give you a great salute. And then I'd drive around, then I'd go out the front gate and I'd come in the back gate and they'd salute. So I'd do that a little while, and then I'd, you know, go goof off the rest of the day, probably go bowling or something. But, and so I swore that someday I was going to have a bright yellow Triumph TR6 like my dad's. The only difference is, like you said, the wheels. His was a 76, mine's a 74. And shortly after we moved here to Spruce Creek, I was driving around one of the taxiways, and somebody had a hangar door that was cracked open maybe 2 feet, and I could see the very bottom of the rear bumper of that car. I knew exactly what it was, and I actually went and knocked on the door and introduced myself and asked if I could see it. And it was almost freshly, you know, ground up restoration. It looks brand new. And I kind of got to know the guy, and I asked if it was for sale. And of course he could tell that I was rabid about this car. So he offered me this crazy price that I couldn't afford. And then we got to actually become genuine friends. And a few years later we did the deal, because he knew that I was going to have it one of these days. So I finally got my Triumph. And again, I wish I could carry my iMac over there. I'll have to send you a picture, but I've got a personalized license plate on it. Oh, and one of the other reasons I knew it was going to ultimately be my car is the gentleman I bought it from was named Ralph, and he was a former Marine. And so he had a Florida Marine Corps license plate on it. So I figured, well, that was a good omen. So now my Triumph, which used to be Ralph, still has a Marine Corps license plate on it. And the word on my license plate is, it's French. It's ENFIN, which loosely translates to the word finally. So I finally got my Triumph, and it's sitting right there.
Ah, very good.
And you can't see it. Well, here, I can kind of give you. I've also got a 74 Jeep CJ5 sitting right there.
So you're like a lot of pilots.
I like old airplanes. I like old cars.
You're like a lot of pilots. I know that their hangar is not only for their airplane, but it's also to hide their other toys.
Oh, yeah. Got to have toys. There'll be cars. There'll be golf carts. You never know what airplane's going to be sitting in here. Either I'll be working on somebody's, or maybe we'll have the extra over here, the Cub. And it's kind of like just a moving target all the time, what you're going
to
see.
So what has been the most interesting airplane that you've had to work on?
Ooh, well, you got to define interesting. I mean, I guess, you know, what's going to top having had a hand in designing and building, maintaining, and then hanging up one in the Smithsonian. That, I don't know that that can be topped. And that airplane had some very cool features on it that we came up with just to make it easy to maintain. And I mean, there was just so many things about that airplane that were unique. That would probably have to take the cake. I've got to work on, fortunately, a lot of different airplanes, but that one holds a special place in my heart.
Let's go ahead and let you take over about Reno.
Well, I'm kind of on the periphery of what's going on at Reno. As you know, the Reno Air Races are no more. Unfortunately, they were evicted, for lack of a better term. And so we're actually going to have an air show in Reno this year. A lot of people aren't aware, and we're going to have two jet teams there. So we're going to have the Thunderbirds and the Snowbirds flying at Reno in October. And so that's going to be kind of like the last hurrah. And actually, it's an event that may actually continue from year to year. Ultimately, I think that Stead Airport is just going to become so overgrown and overtasked with other things that they probably won't even be able to support the air show someday. But we're hoping to keep it going. But the new home is Roswell, New Mexico. It's funny. A lot of people know my relationship with Fred Telling, who's the chairman and CEO of the Reno Air Racing Association. And so when it became evident that the association was going to have to find a new home, I had a lot of people offering up advice on where they should go. And I would point out that there's a lot of factors that have to fall into place. And there's really no way you're ever going to end up with another identical copy of Reno. There's just too many things that were unique about, you know, between the amount of land, the gambling, the number of hotels, commercial air service, you know, it's a nice area. And so they would propose a place and it would be missing some of those critical factors. And, you know, and you also got to remember, it's got to be in a place that people actually want to go to. You can't just have it just be in the middle of nowhere. And you got to be able to get there and you got to have somewhere to sleep once you get there. So, and the most important is it's got to be a place that wants you to come there. So, what they did was they put out a request for proposal and accepted requests from a number of cities that thought they wanted to have the races. There were certain criteria that had to be met that a lot of them didn't have. So those immediately got dismissed and they just kept whittling it down more and more and more. We ended up with a final six contenders. The board of directors of the Reno Air Race Association went and visited all of those locations. And then the class presidents from all the different racing classes at Reno also went and visited the finalists when they narrowed them down to see what they thought of it, you know, because they're the ones that are actually going to be having to fly over the course and run the operation for each of their organizations. So in the end, they finally narrowed it down to three. We did a lot more site visits, and then Roswell came out on top. And every single one of those last three communities, Casper, Pueblo, and Roswell, were super enthusiastic. I mean, it was a very, I had nothing to do with the decision. I was flying Mr. Telling from site to site and just got to kind of sit in and listen and watch some of what was going on. But I can tell you that they were all very enthusiastic. They all had a lot to offer. But in the end, Roswell just won out. They had the most to offer. And so that's going to be the new home. The first actual racing is going to be next year. We're actually going out there next week to start doing some work. And board members have been coming and going out there trying to get the ball rolling. So it's a great community. I've never seen such enthusiasm. We had the press conference about a month ago, and there was over 200 or 300 local people from the area. And they're looking at it as a way to support not just Roswell, but the whole that region of New Mexico. It's going to be very popular. The lieutenant governor showed up, so they definitely are on board with it. There's going to be some challenges for sure. There's not a lot of hotel rooms like Reno. There's not a lot of commercial air traffic, but they've got some plans in place to try to overcome that, and I think it's going to be a great event.
Sounds like it's going to be a wonderful event, and hopefully you guys can arrange for an Area 51 tour.
That's right.
That would be fun to add
Nevada.
To it.
That's in Nevada. Actually, it's funny you mentioned that because, you know, the Roswell and the alien and the spaceship, that is a very big part of their livelihood in Roswell. It is everywhere. And I think I heard that either this week or last week is they have some kind of a annual alien convention. And the number I heard is 40,000 people come from all around the world to come to Roswell for that week, whether it's this week or last week. So clearly they're staying somewhere. We'll figure out where they're staying. And, you know, the nice thing, in addition to Roswell itself as a community, they're talking about potentially employing the Oshkosh style and come up with a lot of camp areas, campgrounds where people can either tent or bring RVs. But then also the town of Ruidoso is about an hour away. So very similar to how Stead would be in relation to Tahoe. It's kind of a resort community and a lot to offer up there. So it's going to be a great economic boom to that region of New Mexico. You know, the air races have a new home. And I can tell you that, contrary to popular rumors, they didn't pick Roswell so that they wouldn't have to change the logo. Everybody thinks. I've heard that a lot. The only reason they pick Roswell is because it will still be RARA, Reno Air Race Association versus Roswell Air Race Association. That's not true.
Yes, but I could see the T-shirts requiring a bit more lettering because Reno is four letters and Roswell is seven, I believe.
Oh, well, I invite you to look up the new logo that they created just for the, you know, trying to entice the association to choose Roswell. They took the existing RARA logo and incorporated some of the alien graphics to create this new logo. It's an outstanding outstandingly well done job that they did.
All right, Brian, I greatly appreciate you and everything that you do. I've enjoyed our friendship over the years, and thank you for spending some time with us here.
Absolutely. It's been fun. And I guess this means I have to go back to work now.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, thank you very much, Brian.
Thanks, Ray. Enjoy your day.